Okay, so the canonical picture of the contents of the universe, the pieces that I need today are the hydrogen and helium gas, which are today at more like 5%. And then I need the dark matter, because that's what the early universe was made of, those two components. So after we called these things dark stars, we learned about this cult film. And these are the people that I did this work with. So I started this project with Doug Spoliar and Paolo Gondolo. And then since then, we've been working with a lot of other people as well. Monica Valori, Pearl Sandick, Anthony Aguirre, Peter Bodenheimer, and others. So I just want to start with a simple slide that tells you what these things are. So we're talking about the first stars to form in the history of the universe. That's at about a redshift of 15 or so, when the universe was 200 million years old. And what we discovered is that the first stars could actually be powered by dark matter annihilation instead of by fusion. So there's no fusion yet anywhere. But the point I want to make really, really clear is that these are objects made of hydrogen and helium almost entirely. It's one part in 10 to the 3 dark matter. And they really are stars, normal stars, but they have a weird power source. So it's atomic matter that shines to dark matter, and it can be really, really bright, even a billion times as bright as the sun. And that leads to detectability, which I'm going to talk about. So as an outline, I want to tell you first about the standard picture of the first stars, which is what people worked on before considering what dark matter might do, and then talk about the properties of the dark matter that we need for our idea to work. And once a dark star is born, then we do the stellar structure of these things, and we watch them grow, and they potentially can become supermassive and super bright. And then when they die, they become black holes. In fact, this could be the origin of the supermassive black holes in the universe. Okay, so let me start, as I said, with the standard picture of the first stars, which are the first luminous objects ever in the history of the universe. And they're made only of hydrogen and helium from the Big Bang, because that's all there is at that point. It's only the later stars that are going to make all the other elements, the carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and so forth. So the reason that the first stars form at this particular time inside halos of a million solar masses is, I'll show you in a minute, but let me just back up and remind you about the hierarchical picture of structure formation, where you start with small objects first, maybe Earth-sized objects, and they merge together to make bigger ones. And eventually those merge together to make million solar mass ones, and those are the things that people call mini halos, and that's where the stars form. And those things then merge to make galaxies and clusters and so on. Okay, so why a million solar masses? What you have is a cloud of molecular hydrogen at the center of these mini halos. And that cloud of hydrogen wants to collapse and head towards becoming a protostar. But in order to collapse, it needs to give off energy. It needs to cool. And the cooling is molecular hydrogen cooling, which cools efficiently at around 1,000 Kelvin. And that's what you get inside these million solar mass halos of dark matter. That's the virial temperature of these things. So this cloud of hydrogen is able to start collapsing towards making a star. So here's a slide as I move to the right in this picture. That's the number density of hydrogen. In other words, as you move to the right in this picture, you're moving forward in time. And up here is the temperature that's associated with the different stages of this collapsing thing. So you follow this gray curve here, and you'll see there's a list of all different kinds of hydrogen that becomes important. The hydrogen, the different chemistry that the hydrogen experiences, so different pieces of chemistry. So that's the standard picture of the first stars. And just to show a few slides, this is from a simulation of Yoshida, starting from very large scales. These are megaparsec scales, getting smaller as you start having this self-gravitating cloud at the center of the halo, and continuing to collapse until in this standard picture of the first stars, you would have a protostar here, and it's a very small thing. It has the radius of about 10 times the sun, and has a mass of 10 to the minus 3 solar masses. So in this standard picture, you make this nugget of hydrogen. And to show the different mass scales, here's what here's in the standard picture, this is what happens. So as I said, you have this collapsing hydrogen cloud that becomes a protostar of 10 to the minus 3 solar masses, and then it accretes mass back onto that thing. And the accretion stops at some point because these are hot objects. They have fusion going on in the core, and they have ionizing photons coming out, and they have accretion disks, and the photons hit the accretion disk, and they stop the accretion. So these things sort of peter out at 100 solar masses, and that's it. And they're not big and bright, so you can never see them with the James Webb Space Telescope, for example. However, with what we did, when taking into account the dark matter, as you'll see, you end up with no constraint. No, we don't have these constraints on the accretion, so you could grow to be much, much bigger, maybe even a million or 10 million solar masses. And now you've got something that's big and bright, and you can actually see it with telescopes. So I guess the way this happened is people were talking about the first stars, and we asked, okay, in the centers of these mini halos, there is a lot of dark matter, and what happens? So the reason that these first stars are a particularly interesting place to look is because they're at the right place and the right time. They're forming in the middles of these mini halos where there's a lot of dark matter. Let's contrast that with the sun. So we're 8,000 kiloparsecs away from the center of the galaxy, and that means we do not have enough dark matter inside the sun to power the sun. What can happen is that you can capture some dark matter, which settles to the core and annihilates, and you can look for those annihilation products, and the Ice Cube experiment is doing that. They're looking for neutrinos in particular coming from the direction of the sun. For that matter, we also have the same thing going on the Earth. We collect these particles inside the center of the Earth, and you can look for signatures of that. But the sun is not powered by dark matter. But as I said, these early things form in the middles of these halos where there's a lot more dark matter, and so that's the right place to be. The early universe is also higher redshift, which means the density is higher, and that helps too, but that's really a secondary effect. Okay, so what properties of the dark matter are we talking about? Well, we're talking about standard WIMPs. So weakly interacting massive particles, which means they have masses between a GeV and maybe 10 TeV. As the canonical case, we'll take 100 GeV, but we'll consider the entire mass range. The picture doesn't change. The other ingredient from particle physics is the cross-section, which is a weakly interacting cross-section. And this is the one that everybody uses for standard WIMPs. And this is the one that gives you the right WIMP abundance in the early universe. So in the early universe, everything was in thermal equilibrium. And we're talking about the WIMPs that annihilate among themselves. And they would do that in the early universe until the expansion of the universe made them too far apart for the annihilation to happen. And if you have this weak cross-section, then you end up with the right amount of WIMPs left over today from the early universe. So that's the same number that we're using. And again, this can vary by 5 orders of magnitude. It doesn't change the story. It's also the same annihilation that gives potentially observable signals in a variety of detectors, because although the annihilation in the average universe has stopped, if you look at overdense regions, you will expect to see signatures of the annihilation. So I was debating, I could have put in some slides about all the different ways that people are looking for WIMPs, and I have them at the end of the talk for people who want to hear a summary of what's going on. So this is the same Feynman diagram, which is, it's stupid to plot it in three times, but the idea is you, in these pictures, read it from left to right, so you can look for the annihilation products, you can look for the scattering off of protons, or you can produce it. 2 protons can make it at the LHC. So those are 3 ways that people are looking for it, and actually dark stars might be another way to look for it. So I will, however, do an aside, because I don't think this is something that people hear about necessarily, so I do want to talk about the direct detection briefly. So I have a few slides on this and what the status is. So here you have a nucleus with a dark matter with a WIMP scattering off of it, and the latest xenon results are actually 10 to the minus 4 counts per kilogram per day per EV, the count is what they're at, which is ridiculous. That's how good this is. So, and the amount of energy deposited is around a KeV. Pathetically difficult experiments. I don't know if I should bother showing you some of the history of this. This is. Sorry?
Where is the xenon experiment?
In Gran Sasso. So I don't know if I should go back to 1984 on this, but this business was started by Drucker and Stadalsky. I met Drucker at a winter school in Jerusalem where he was speaking at the time English, French, Polish, and German all at the same time. He's Polish. I still work with him, okay? And he told me about this work he'd done with Leo Stadalsky. You can look for neutrinos. It's elastic scattering. However, Goodman and Witten realized, well, yeah, but WIMPs are massive. They deposit more energy. You can do it more easily. So that was the first of that. And then we wrote the second paper on it. This is with David Spergel, where we did, well, I did Feynman diagrams. I computed the count rates of individual particles. Now you can get 10 to the, I don't know how many, in various codes that people, it's just all automated. And David did the astrophysics. And so the event rates are, well, number density times cross section, n sigma v is the rate of interaction as usual. And you split it into a particle physics and an astrophysics part where this is the distribution of WIMPs in the galaxy. And this is a particle physics over here, which we don't know the details of it. There's many, many possibilities. And the calculations that we did got people building experiments. They're now all over, including Gran Sasso, in answer to your question. Okay, so the reason I'm mentioning this is because people don't hear that much about DAMA, but you should. So the idea of DAMA is the following. Well, the sun moves around the center of the galaxy, so we're moving into the wind of WIMPs. Just like when it rains, you're driving into rain that looks like it's coming at you. But it varies with the time of year because the Earth goes around the sun. So you would expect a peak count rate in June and a minimum in December. Okay, they have 10 cycles of exactly that. So that's their data. And the black curve is a cosine, and it matches with the peak at the right place. And it's a 9 sigma effect. And what the hell is going on?
Why does it stop in 2010?
Because I made the slide a while ago.
It's kept going.
So have they released stuff since then? I don't know that they have. Anybody know? I don't know what they've released since then. I don't think a lot. But who cares? This is 9 sigma. I mean, it's not going away, okay? But and so, oh, dark matter's been discovered. Well, maybe. So two big problems. One is they will not let anybody see the data, which is really, really weird, okay? And the other one is that nobody else sees anything. So I have to, I couldn't resist, okay? So these are the group leaders. She leads DAMA, Cogent, and Elena Prelay-Zenon, the PI of the paper we were just referring to, and I just love this quote. I'm a Spaniard caught between two Italian women. So these people are never gonna agree, even if they should agree. But in fact, they really don't. So if I cross plot WIMP mass versus cross section, okay, so if you want to match DAMA, you either had to scatter off of sodium, which is this green curve at 10 GeV, or you had to scatter off iodine, which is this green curve. On the other hand, lux and xenon don't see anything, and that bound just got tighter. Oh my god, it's down here now. So, yeah, 10 is 5 times 10 to the minus 47. So, oh, that rules out DAMA, so you might say. Okay, wait a minute. To make this plot, I had to assume a particular type of scattering. I didn't talk much about it on the previous slide, but it's assumed scattering scales as atomic mass, no, atomic number, which the A, whichever one that is, atomic mass squared. Coherent scattering, that may not be true. If you make that assumption, then you can plot things on the same curve, and then you can say it's ruled out. Second problem is that these experiments, it's hard to tell in this picture, but they're right at threshold, and so people are wondering, yeah? This is a deviation from what I was supposed to talk about, but I think it's important. Go ahead.
Xenon 110 just came out with new results.
Yeah.
So they're below 10 to the minus 46.
Yeah, I know. That's what I just said. A few times.
Said,
I did, yeah. Yes, for from here on, wait, from 10 GeV on up, which is exactly where the DAMA is sitting, so they don't. People argue, not me. I don't know anything about thresholds. But so that what has to happen, oh, One more thing I have to say about Dhamma. Here's the thing. There is no proposed alternative explanation, not a background of any kind anybody can think of. So you got to go. So I didn't take any of this seriously until Frank Halaprice at Princeton, and he's Mr. T violation. I mean, sensitive experiments, really, really good guy. And he says, we have to go test this. So he's doing it. He's doing it. So maybe you have heard about this. OK, good. So there's now three groups that do have, let me back up. The other thing about Dhamma is they wouldn't let anybody buy crystals from the company. Dhamma's made of sodium iodide, and they're the only ones that had the crystals. So how can you, you've got to build an experiment of the same material, and you got to go take it to the southern hemisphere or whatever, something new. Well, now they're making their own, and Halaprice's are better. Okay, so that's the Sabre experiment, and that is going to go very soon. There's two more that are also doing it. Raina Murayama put some small crystals into the ice at the South Pole, and they immediately got data going there. But she's now collaborating with a Korean group, and it's now called Cosine 100, and so that's also going to go. And on ICE, they have lower quality crystals, so they're going to take longer. Okay, so anyway, Dhamma will get tested.
There are alternative explanations for
the actually, not that I not nobody I know has one that works. And this is not just my opinion, okay? Okay, so I apologize. I don't know if that was interesting to you or not, but everyone talks about all the other experiments, and this one you never hear about, and I think it's the only one that has unexplained data, so it's worth it. Let me get back to dark stars. And so the physics is you have two WIMPs, chi is a WIMP, annihilating into whatever, W's or whatever, and then the end products of the decay are typically photons, positrons, and neutrinos. And those are exactly the things that people are looking for in indirect detection experiments that I'm not talking about. And it's the same annihilation process, again, that gives the WIMP, the WIMPs we see today from annihilation of the early universe. It gives signatures to look for, and it powers stars. And as far as the basic picture goes, you have this collapsing cloud of hydrogen. As it collapses, it pulls in even more dark matter. Then the dark matter annihilates, and those annihilation products get stuck inside this collapsing cloud of hydrogen. Neutrinos get out, but everything else gets stuck. So it gets stuck, it thermalizes with the star, and it provides energy to the star. So that's where the dark matter heating comes from. And so this collapsing cloud stops collapsing. And tell them to mute, will you? So that's the beginning of the what?
The world is calling in.
It's Doug Spoliar calling in. So I wanted to contrast dark matter power versus fusion. Fusion is only less than 1% efficient, in the sense that only a fraction of the nuclear mass is released as energy. Dark matter power is, well, at least it's not me. It could have been me, right? Okay, so fusion is wimpy, ha ha ha, compared to WIMPs. So essentially, most of the particle mass can turn into energy to power the star. So it's the power of darkness. It's good stuff. Another major difference is that fusion only happens when you have something hot. So the star has to collapse, get very dense and hot at the core, and then you have the fusion only in the core. Dark matter doesn't care about temperature. So you can have a big diffuse thing, and the dark matter annihilation happens everywhere throughout the star. It's not concentrated at the center. So it took us actually a long time to realize what that means is that you actually have a star. You don't just have this thing with dark matter in it. It's a real star. It's so weird having no core. It's just powered throughout. So
doesn't that depend on the dark matter profile you assume?
Coming. And the answer is no. So you lead right into my first question, which is for dark stars to work, you have to have a sufficiently high dark matter density. And I have probably too many slides on this. So let me just get to the point where I've answered your question. So the annihilation rate is number density squared times n squared sigma v, number density of Wimp squared, times the cross-section for annihilation. That's the annihilation rate per volume. And then you multiply that by the mass of the Wimp, so that gives you the potential heating rate. Or if I want to write that in terms of mass density rho, then that's rho squared times cross-section over mass, because the thing that's controlled by gravity is actually rho. So this is the more useful way to write it. And then you can also see that it depends on cross-section over mass. So I'm going to show you results for, I'm going to show results for a variety of masses, which is equivalent to considering a variety of cross-sections. So this, you have to have a large enough density of dark matter. And I'll show you some pictures where we start from a standard NFW profile inside the halo. Then as the hydrogen collapses, it pulls in more dark matter. And we treated that via adiabatic contraction. So this is just plain gravity. That's the dark matter that's there due to gravity. Later on, you can get even more dark matter. This is a second possible way to get dark matter, and that is the same cross-section that I was using to show you for the direct detection. You can capture more later, but you don't need that. You can just, it can be just purely gravitational. So this is what simulations indicate that the centers of dark matter halos look like. An NFW profile, 1 over r near the center, which is the part relevant for us, 1 over r cubed farther out. I do want to say right off the bat that it doesn't matter. I have a slide later on where I'll show we also took a core, and you still get the same thing happening. So this is, we just did this to do something, but you don't we don't require this 1 over r near the center. So the way adiabatic contraction works, this is a really, really ridiculously simple approach to figuring out what happens. It's basically angular momentum conservation. You have a particle, a dark matter particle on one orbit, and then as the baryons collapse, the dark matter particles get on a different orbit. And this is very simplistic. It was done by these guys initially for galaxies. But the bottom line is, although it's simplistic in every single case that it's used, including for galaxies, it works. It gives you the right answer. It's fine. What you have to follow what the baryons do, and here's what the baryons do. This is from simulations of the first stars, where you start out with a density profile of hydrogen that's like this. And then as time goes on, this is the collapsing star. The density goes up and the object gets smaller. And so we did simple calculations of starting from an NFW profile. How does the dark matter respond to those baryon profiles I just showed you, and here you go. This thing, the dark matter also gets more dense. But as I said, if we start instead of with NFW, we start with a flat profile, which is way overly conservative, then you also get additional dark matter, and it's plenty to get the effects, to get the behavior that we need. That's a picture of the same thing. This is the dark matter response. And then people got very worried, is there really enough dark matter in there? And so we actually worked with Jerry Selwood to do an exact calculation using adiabatic invariance, where you get the same answer, differs only by a factor of 2 from the results I just showed you. So it works. Not only that, but the people who were skeptics also did the calculations and also got the same answer. Okay, so you don't have to worry about the dark matter density. The next thing that would be that you have to have the annihilation products getting stuck in the star. And here's where, with some particle physics background, we were able to make a contribution that others had missed, because they thought the annihilation products got out of the star. They were assuming ionization. Some simple calculations they did that were wrong, because when you have a 100 GeV photon, It has electromagnetic cascades. So it produces E plus E minus pairs, which then Bremsstrahlung photons and so on and so forth. And that's a very different process than that had been ignored. So, and this is, it's in the particle data book. You can look up the answer. And if you do that, then, well, we demanded 80 radiation lengths. This stuff does not get out. So that's, so I have some numbers for you. Actually, no, I'm gonna wait on the numbers. All right, so the third effect that you absolutely need is for the heating to beat the cooling. And as I said, that's the potential heating, but the problem is that some things do get out. Well, neutrinos escape. The others don't. And then you compare the heating to the cooling, and the question is, when does the heating win? And here are the numbers. For a 100 GeV particle, when the number density of hydrogen is 10 to the 13 per cubic centimeter, that's when heating wins over cooling. That's when the collapse would stop. And that is a factor of 10 to the 10 lower than the density of the normal first stars or something like that. So you really you stop the process quite early. Or depending on the Wimp mass, you would get different numbers. So as far as this third criterion of heating beating cooling, I have this plot I want to show you. This is the same picture I showed before. This blue curve is the standard picture of the first stars with the chemistry in there. And the red curves are for different Wimp masses. And if you're on one side of the red curves, then heating beats cooling. If you're on the other side, then it doesn't. So what we're looking for is where the red and blue curves cross. So for the 100 GeV particle, that's at a number density of 10 to the 13, which is why I said that's the density of hydrogen at the time the this thing becomes a dark star. Well, that was a very simple Mathematica code written by Doug Spoliar. And instead, you know, Naoki Yoshida has a heavy-duty code where he did the same thing and got the same answer. Yay. So at the time the heating wins, you already have a very weird object. These are puffy, diffuse stars. Their radii are maybe 10 to 100 AU, the distance between the Earth and the Sun. And their masses are of order 1 to 10 solar masses. And the dark matter is less than 1% of the mass of the star, but is providing the heat source. OK, so then, as I said, from there on, it took us another year to realize they really are stars. And we've worked with Peter Bodenheimer using his stellar evolution codes, I think dating to the 1970s, and put in this new heat source. So you make the assumption that you have this equation of state. This is polytropic between the pressure and the energy density, characterized by this number n. And all stars are polytropes, effectively. It's another one of these simple things that works. So n is 3 halves, or goes for convective stars, and n equals 3 for radiative stars. So we looked for actual equilibrium solutions with hydrostatic equilibrium and with thermal equilibrium. In other words, the dark matter energy has to equal the luminosity coming out of the star. So with these initial objects that we got, this one solar mass object, you adjust the radius until you have these equilibrium conditions met. And so we did this in steps. I'm trying to get the next slide. OK, so you started with a one solar mass object, find an equilibrium star. Add on another solar mass, find an equilibrium star, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Keep building it up, and you get very large first stars. And so you can keep growing, but you ask the question, OK, when do you run out of fuel? So I'll get back to that in a minute, but I do want to show you here that these are the baryons, the number density of baryons as a function of radius versus the dark matter. And you really can see the dark matter is very low in terms of its contribution to the mass of the star. It does all the heating, but it's irrelevant as far as the mass. And here's a picture as a function of time of the luminosity of one of these things. So the red curve is the total luminosity as a function of time. And initially, the black curve, you can't even see it, it's annihilation powered at first. But now let's say you run out of dark matter. Okay, so the annihilation shuts off. The star has to collapse because it's lost the pressure from the dark matter heating. So you get gravity actually being the power source briefly. That's the green curve. And then fusion kicks in. So at first there's deuterium burning, then there's all the usual fusion that starts. So you can observe that happening inside these codes. So let me give you the basic picture.
Mm-hmm. So let's say dark matter runs out, and there's of course dark matter farther out.
Just wait, just wait. I love your questions. Exactly what I'm getting to after this slide. At least I think so. But just to repeat that we can end up with things that are more massive than 1,000 solar masses. They're very large in radius. They can be very luminous. They're cool. They can be long-lived. And I'm about to turn to this question of how big do they get, which depends on how long can they have dark matter fuel. Well, so at first we thought, okay, these are in a very small radius, and you're going to run out of the dark matter that's inside there. And if that were true, you would end up at 1,000 solar masses. That's the paper we wrote. Then Monica Baluri said, no, 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 no. By the way, you should get her here, because she can tell you about dark matter orbits. And this is galactic dynamic. It's along the lines of what's in Binney and Tremaine, but you know, it's up the modern stuff. And dark matter orbits are really weird. So more than half of them are on, I think I have some pictures here. Where are they? They're either on box orbits or chaotic orbits. And in any case, they're centrophilic. They come back to the middle. So you don't run out of dark matter in the middle, because the dark matter particle that got annihilated away never was coming back anyhow. The next one comes from somewhere else. So this same problem has been done in other circumstances, and it's called refilling the loss cone. And we really, it's one of the millions of projects that we should do to do this properly. So we don't know when the dark matter runs out. It's also complicated by the fact that your original million solar mass halo is going to merge with other ones and make bigger objects, but then merge and da-da-da. So the question is, now let's say you've got 1,000 solar mass thing sitting in the middle of this mini halo that's merging. Will it end up at the center of the next thing where there's lots of dark matter? Will it do that quickly enough? So it becomes a cosmology question exactly of how the dark matter is creating large-scale structure. So we don't know when they stop growing. So for now, I would just say let her rip, let them grow. But don't assume that all of them will do that. So I guess I've already said this now, but the point is, if you just let them grow, they're going to grow to be quite big. And that's something very detectable. Did I have a comment? You know, there's a comment I wanted to make. This is, I don't know where I have it. Yeah, here it is. The key difference between this and fusion power is that because the stars are big and puffy, they're also cool. So the surface temperature of 10,000 Kelvin means there's no ionizing photons coming off, so there's nothing to prevent accretion. So that's a big difference from most things. The standard POP3, the standard first stars are 100,000 Kelvin. That's why they stop growing. So I want to show a picture this is a Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. This is luminosity versus surface temperature of the star. So if you look at these dotted curves, for example, the 100 GeV WIMP is this red curve right here. And you can watch the thing get bigger and more luminous. And we did this numerically, and we found the mass is proportional to luminosity up there. Well, guess what? 1963, Fowler and Hoyle. If you have a supermassive star, regardless of heat source, that's what you get in about three lines. Billy Fowler being my academic grandfather. So I guess our codes are okay. But anyway, that was fun to have to go back to 1963. But we certainly have a different power source. And so let me talk now about the curves on the left. Let's say you run out of this gravity-powered dark matter. Then the stars start to collapse. So this is a shrinking object. That's getting hotter and hotter. Now, because it's shrinking and the number density is getting bigger, that means it can start to capture more WIMPs that happen to pass through. So you have a second source of WIMPs inside the star. And once those become important, then again, you can have they can also power the star. So that's the second way, it's sort of a second phase. So, but that second phase depends on what exactly the elastic scattering is, what the cross-section is, and so on. And we've taken the cross-section that is still allowed by data, but so the initial formation of the objects only relies on annihilation. But if you want to have the second stage, that relies on the capture, the same capture that was used for the Dama experiment. The same cross-section that was used for the Dama experiment. Okay, yep, same picture again. That's what causes the capture of the second phase. Either way, you're getting to some very bright things up here. So this is a billion solar luminosities up here, and that was for either with the gravitational or with the captured dark matter. And so at that point, John Mather and John Gardner, PIs of James Webb Space Telescope, got very excited, and they said, tell us what to look for. How many will you see? What will they look like? Well, here's a spectrum of what you will see, which is essentially a black body curve. And then as far as how many, that's a really tough one. But Paul Shapiro helped us out by computing the formation rate of the mini halos. That's a good starting point. And you'll see it peaks at a redshift of 12. So pretty much everything, the formation peaks at a redshift of 12, large scale structure. So one thing you can do already is look at Hubble Space Telescope, which is actually already, on the one hand, is already placing bounds on dark stars. So you would have seen that 10 to the 7 solar mass dark stars that lived to a redshift of 10, you would have seen them and you didn't. So that places bounds on them. So all of these observations, the way they work is dropouts. So in Hubble, it looks for J-band dropouts. That means you see it. Let's see, look at this one. Okay, so you see it in one band, you see it in one wavelength, but you do not see it in the other wavelength. And the reason for that is that you have Lyman alpha absorption as a function of redshift. It eats up everything. It eats up all the light in one of these wavelength filters, but not the other stuff. And so by doing that, you can determine the redshifts of objects. So that's how Hubble gets the redshift. So it says, we have a redshift 10 objects, because it sees these dropouts. I'm an idiot. I forgot to put in a slide I wanted to show you, because now there's a new redshift 11 object in Hubble Space Telescope that could be a dark star. And we talked 6 months ago with the first author of that paper, and he's very interested, supposedly, and we sent him the spectra, and he's supposed to go check, and he hasn't done it. So he's in Holland. Maybe when I go back to Europe, I'll go bug him, because that would be pretty cool. But it's going to be hard to tell with one object what it is.
How long is the dark star? I just missed
it. I can't hear you. What?
How long is the dark star?
How long they live?
Yeah, how long live it is. Is it? How long live?
Oh. Well, it depends however long you keep getting dark matter fuel. So I think in the ones that we did here, we assumed they were forming at a redshift of 15, and this is what they look like at a redshift of 10. So they can last millions of or even billions of years in principle. We don't see a lot of them around today, which I would find very surprising anyhow, because a lot has happened in the universe since a redshift of 15. So, So I can't answer that, but a variety of ages. All right, the James Webb is the place to look. So these are the limits of what James Webb can do, depending on how long you look in a particular direction, and these things will definitely be visible, and I have better plots coming. This is an H-band dropout now. Here's a million solar mass one that you would see in a 2-micron filter, but not a 1.5-micron one, which means it's a redshift 12 object. So that's the kind of thing you'll see. So why James Webb? Well, it's able to go into the micron. It's an infrared telescope as well as visible, so it's looking farther back in time. That's what we need. How many would you see? Okay, I don't know. But we did some estimates depending on what fraction of those mini halos contains a dark star. And so you can see between 1 and 400,000. So you have to go look. Okay,
so can you go back to what's the difference between these predictions? Why is such a difference?
Okay, so one of the questions was, if they live till redshift 10 and they have the bounds from HST that I told you about. Okay, so that's one of the differences. The other one depends. Okay, I don't remember what's in this plot, but it also depends how long you look in a particular direction. Depends what fraction of the mini halos contains these objects. It depends on a number of different things. So I would have to carefully read this figure caption to table caption right now, which we'll do it later. But you get the idea. Those are the things that matter. Well, the HSD pounds of redshift 10 depends whether they live that long or not. But those are in there, and those are the lower ones, the lower counts. Okay, this is the same kind of stuff. You can look in different filters, and look at the numbers you'll get in these different filters. Okay, let's say you find something. So let's say you already know that it has is very bright. It's cool. It has the 10,000 Kelvin surface temperature. How do you differentiate it from an early galaxy? So one of the ways that we thought of to do that is to look for pulsations, because stars pulsate, whereas galaxies don't. And so we went initially from Mathematica code, we went from there to the Fortran code of Peter Bodenheimer, and now most recently, the nightmarish MESA code. It's one of these giant big beasts. It was written by Bill Paxton, who was the founder of Adobe Acrobat, and he now lives in, he's at the Institute for Theoretical Physics in Santa Barbara. I don't think they pay him, but he's writing these beautiful codes and working with people, and I guess enjoying himself. However, I hope he's not listening to me call it a horrible code, but any code that's big is horrible. So we're trying to figure out the pulsations. These are some initial estimates, and they actually seem to be holding up, but I don't, anyway, so some of these, the best ones would be in today's time frame when we measure here, things that are pulsations of order a month. And people tell me, actually, we thought that was great, but apparently of order a year is better, because that's when they'll probably be looking anyhow for things that have that kind of time scale. But the moral of the story is, if you see something pulsating regularly, then it's more likely to be a star than a galaxy, even if we don't get the time scales right. Okay, so in answer to your question, the dark star continues to live as long as you have dark matter fuel, which could be millions to billions of years. I guess I already said this, so I'm going to skip that. But now what happens when you run out of fuel? Then the smaller ones will get denser and they'll have fusion. So then you'll revert to a more normal type of behavior. But the largest ones may skip that entirely and convert directly to black holes. But in any case, either way, you will end up with big black holes. And that's a good thing. So imagine you have million solar mass black holes in the very early universe. That is really good too, because there are a lot of unexplained black holes in the universe. They're certainly at the center of every galaxy. But more interesting are very high redshift black holes that are very hard to make. Oh, wait, I don't have a picture of the black hole. Oh.
They're working on it.
No, there's observations of things that are, you've got 10 to the 10 solar mass black holes at a redshift of 6, okay? It's bigger than this, 10 billion at a redshift of 6. And it's very hard to make that if you start with 100 solar mass objects and merge them together, you'll never get there. So if you start with a million solar mass objects, those are much better seeds for doing this. So that's really nice. Usually you come up with a new idea and it gets killed. But in this case, we solved a problem that we hadn't heard of before. That was great. I'm not sure how much of this I want to talk about, except to say that if there are the early dark stars of any size could turn into black holes, and they would be around today. So not the stars themselves would be around today, but the black holes would. And they would still have some dark matter around them, and maybe you could see annihilation products of the dark matter that's around them. And so we were looking at that. That's with Pearl Sandick and Jörg Diemann giving us numbers of these. Oh, here it is. This is the black hole. It got out of order, sorry. So this is the object I wanted to tell you about, this 10 to the 10 million, 10 billion solar mass black hole at a redshift of 6 that we would be able to help explain. But so back on the smaller black holes, So I hadn't realized that between us and the galactic center, there could be millions of little black holes that could be all over the place. And if they have some dark matter attached to them, the annihilation from that is something you could look for. And for example, the Fermi satellite looks for gamma rays, and it could see them. And we weren't the only ones looking for that. But that's a way to constrain the fraction of the mini halos that would have dark stars inside them, depending on looking at the point sources and depending on what the annihilation channels are, because that tells you how many gamma rays you would get. So that's a useful tool for trying to constrain this value, this F. I also thought it was kind of interesting because people want to know what is the initial mass function of the first stars. And it's interesting to speculate that the initial mass function of the fusion stars could be determined by where the dark matter went, because that would determine where the first dark stars went and what they were doing. And that's very complicated. As I said, it depends on the cosmological merger history of the early halos. So I guess in conclusion, dark matter can play a crucial role in the first stars. By the way, we're looking now at self-interacting dark matter, which also will be interesting in these stars. And the role they play is that they would heat the first stars and give you something that could be, oh, you see, this is an old slide. I have to update this. This is before we knew you had these extra dark matter, the refueling. So they can be very big and bright, and you might be able to detect them.
So how is this updated? Instead of the masses can be bigger?
Yeah. It could be like 10 to the 7 solar masses. I don't even want to put slide. I don't know how I managed to not update this slide. Okay, so this should be, this could be much bigger than that. So I updated the luminosity and we forgot to update the mass. So it's not, oh, you should always leave your concluding slide up so people who didn't listen can get the wrong answer? Not good. But I can't fix it right now, so I think I'll stop there.
So I'm a little, is the idea that there's basically just one of these per halo or many per halo?
Yeah.
So why given their masses, even if they're 10 to the 7, I mean, you have a big halo, you'd have little fluctuations, so why can't you get these dark matter stars all over a halo of various sizes and so on?
So the first ones would form inside a million solar mass halos and you'd only have one there. Now it's also possible there's a different type of atomic hydrogen cooling that happens in 10 to the 8 solar mass halos, which I didn't really talk about. So there's a variety of dark matter halos in which these could form, and that would be between 10 to the 6 and 10 to the 8 solar mass halos. So you'd only have one. But now that, let's say that million solar mass halo merges with other things and produces a 10 to the 9 solar mass halo, and sure, you'd have more than you'd have to stay where the dark matter density is high. And so they would they merge with each other then and produce one or what? I don't know. You have to be where the dark matter density is high enough, which means at the center of this million solar mass halo. John?
Recently, a couple of papers were published claiming that observation of distant galaxies, the spreading velocities and partition curves decrease quite rapidly, showing that we don't have dark matter here.
Okay, I have nothing to say on that. People talk about in galaxies, a Mond-like behavior is not bad. In other words, baryons, that's not what you're talking about, okay. But even the people who are pushing that still also believe in dark matter. So I thought that's maybe what you're referring to.
No.
Okay.
This is an observational state.
Okay.
So
I don't know.
The point is that these galaxies should be flat and tissue colors quite far. Come down rapidly. The issue is we still need it farther out from the origin of the galaxy. But if this is true, this is quite significant. They're in that shape.
Okay, I don't know about this. Yeah?
We believe that reionization happened around Richard 10, maybe a bit earlier. would that prevent the burial of this carbon chip part of the process?
Somebody, what is the best number for rhinization now? Somebody?
It's 10.
No, it keeps going down.
Yeah, I think it's like 8, isn't it?
I think it's lower now.
Really. 9.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, it is.
And so it's coming down.
Yeah.
But it's a smooth process, so presumably it begins earlier.
I don't know.
It doesn't happen at once.
Yeah.
But anyway, so given that there was presumably some pretty intense ionizing radiation flying around.
Yeah. So one of the things that this, if we're right about these objects, is that changes the history of reionization, obviously, because these things are not reionizing their surroundings. It's the next generation that do that. However, as soon as you get reionization started, let's say you do have some fusion star or whatever, then that ionizes its neighborhood and it will prevent the formation of dark stars. So that's one of the things that does shut, I didn't talk about that, but yes, it shuts it down. But the other thing I find perplexing is that people are really worried, oh my God, where do we get enough photons to do reionization? Where in fact, if you look at any of the stars, the first, the pop three stars, if you look in their stuff, they're producing lots of reionizing photons. In fact, it seems to me you're over-ionizing the universe. However, as Paul Shapiro points out, that's nonsense, because the minute you start reionization, you shut your neighbors down. So it's self-regulating. So in other words, this reionization business is completely unsolved, if you ask me. It's complicated. But it totally affects what these guys do, yes. Mm-hmm.
How much small-scale power you need for this? So, I mean, your halos are 10 to the 6 solar masses. If you cut that off at 10 to the 9, let's say, is that still low enough to get this, or do you miss the window, the atomic cooling window?
10 to the 9, I think that would be a problem.
Okay.
Do people talk about cutting it off that low?
Well, so it's interesting that the only or the sort of most stringent limit I know of is the Lyman alpha limit. The Lyman alpha limit's around 10 to the 9, a few times 10 to the 9. We don't actually have evidence for anything below that.
Observationally, right.
Observationally.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, it's interesting to have something that you can pin to scales below that, right?
Yeah. So, like with self-interacting dark matter, you cut it off. I don't know exactly, I don't know where. But this what we're talking about happens between, you need somewhere between 10 to the 6 and 10 to the 8 solar masses. Have we thought about what happens in 10 to the 9? No, I didn't feel the need to, but.
I mean, at some point you lose this because you're no longer cooling atomically, right? As you go to higher masses, I think, and you start to fragment.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly what would happen. We haven't thought about something that big. I also think this is actually an idea of Doug Spoliar's, that not with Gaia, but with the next generation, a way to look for substructure. In our Milky Way, let's say you had a 10 to the 7 solar mass halo that went through the disk a million years ago. It produces breathing modes and various modes. And if you look at stellar kinematics, you'd be able to see that. So I think that's really cool. That's a way to look for a smaller structure that was around at some
Does the boost in the dark matter density from adiabatic contraction, do you need that even if you have an effort of
yes.
Even if you have a
that doesn't work. Or, it doesn't work without the adiabatic contraction, yeah.
And what's adiabatic there, just to make sure I understand, is the orbital time is fast relative to the contraction of the what's the idea?
I think that's the usual definition of it about the contraction, and you explode it compared to the orbital. That's the usual.
And that's
the response to the contraction has to be like that, right? That's what you're saying. Is that what you just said?
The contraction is a slope. That's what.
All right, which is the same as what the response to the contraction has to be fast, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
And is that basically saying that the time it takes for a dark matter particle to orbit the orbital period or something is fast relative to the how long it takes for the...
Oh, Jesus. You know, I'm not remembering now. Those time scales should be about the same, though, shouldn't they? So I'm not sure now. I don't know right now. That easily answered question, but I don't want to say the wrong thing.
But there's something that's adiabatic that actually is satisfying.
Yes.
It's not just assumed for simplicity.
That's right. Absolutely, yes. Yeah. Sorry, I should, I'll, we can look that up quickly, but yes, whatever it is.
Thank you.